Thank you very much. As I indicated, we'll take questions at the end of the three presentations. So over to you, Danny.
Thanks, Cliff. Thanks to Cliff, to Anita, to the board for having this discussion. It's great to be on the panel with recently passed colleagues from my time in the administration, Jade and Joy, and a bunch of people in the room who are long past colleagues and now becoming future colleagues again, which is great. I wanted to start by indicating what I see as the big data challenge with respect to privacy. And it's very much, as Cliff stated it, the challenge is serendipitous reuse. There are plenty of large-scale analytic applications, programs, which don't really raise any particular privacy issues at all. If all the data you're analyzing already has a broad consent attached to it for doing research, then there's no really reason for us all to be in this room. If you're prepared to work with data with a level of noise introduced that aggregates it and eliminates privacy risk, then there's also no particular reason to be in this room. But I think I really do agree with Cliff that there are many important situations in which those conditions don't apply. I want to just note that I started to think about this panel and talked with Anita about it before Snowden. There is in the privacy world a kind of before Snowden and after Snowden. And Jade does not have to say anything at all about this, nor John, but I can. I think that in a certain sense, the issues actually haven't changed substantively at all, but the scrutiny to which personal information practices are subject is obviously very much increased, particularly across borders. The stakes, I think, are quite a bit higher because there may be changes in privacy regimes in response to Snowden that could have a substantial impact, positive or negative. And I think, most unfortunately, while these issues are becoming more important, my sense is that the cross-border and global trust levels really are considerably lower than they have been. And I think that, in my mind, that makes it awfully important to make sure that dialogues such as this continue to happen, that they happen not just inside the U.S., but between organizations in the United States and others around the world. I'm going to end by making a case that we actually all have pretty much the same set of problems around the world and should be working on them together. But sort of in the middle of the presentation, I'm going to try to illustrate what I think are some of the differences between particularly the U.S. And Europe when it comes to privacy, because I think understanding those differences can help us to find the path to interoperability, as Jade suggested. Now, there's a lot that's made of differences between the U.S. and Europe on privacy. The caricature is Europe has a lot of it. We don't have very much of it. They care more about it. We don't care at all about it. And you can kind of go on and on in that vein. And I have to say, having spent a couple years in an official capacity in dialogue with European government officials, both having to explain how we think about these issues in the U.S. and having to understand how Europe approaches them, I came away feeling that in many ways the substantive privacy commitments that we have are actually not what separate us. What separates us, I think, much more, and what creates challenges for us are really what are more procedural or jurisprudential issues, but differences between the U.S. legal system and the legal systems that predominate in Europe. In particular, I want to give some illustrations of ways in which the fact that in the U.S. we really have a system that's based on the common law, that's a much more case-by-case approach, which is very different from the European understanding of any legal issue, which is based on what is known as the civil law system, a system that kind of started with the Romans, was formalized by Napoleon in a set of codes, which is a somewhat more top-down attempt to unify all legal rules under a common and hierarchical set of categories. It's more organized in the U.S. We're much messier. And you can kind of argue back and forth about which system works well and how they differ. But the fact of the matter is that we do have different, fundamentally different legal systems, so the way we express our privacy values and the way we implement our privacy values are quite different. That is what gives rise to the need for what's referred to in the administration policy as interoperability. Let me just give you a few examples. To begin with, in the United States, as I think most of you know, we don't have a single omnibus privacy protection statute. We don't have one law that you can go to that says, here are all the privacy rules and they're organized. We have many laws. We have a number of sectors of our society and our economy that are regulated in a whole variety of ways. Joy deals with one particularly big sector, the healthcare sector. It's about a quarter of our economy. But the rules that govern that quarter of the economy are different from the rules that govern financial services or the rules that govern consumer credit information or the rules that govern government access to all this data. And we've evolved this way in the United States such that many sectors are actually quite significantly regulated, and some sectors are not regulated. The online world that we're all used to engaging in is, in some respects, unregulated by any particular statute. Rather, it's taken care of. It's protected. Consumers are protected in that unregulated world by the Federal Trade Commission, which has general authority to protect consumers against unfair and deceptive trade practices. It's using that authority, which doesn't actually once mention privacy, that the Federal Trade Commission has evolved what is essentially a common law of consumer privacy. Europeans look at that, and I shouldn't generalize. Many well-educated, well-informed Europeans look at that and say the U.S. does not have any privacy law. And I used to think this was disingenuous, but I think that it was a kind of a lost in translation moment, because it's true that we don't have the kind of privacy law that Europe has, but we do have lots of laws and lots of rules about privacy that are legally enforceable. Just as one example, the Federal Trade Commission, which I mentioned, really carries the burden of most consumer privacy protection in the online environment and offline. Over the last 4 years, has entered into a series of consent decrees, that is, agreements with a variety of companies about how those companies would change their practices to address findings that the FTC made that they were in some ways being deceptive or misleading to consumers. Those consent decrees cover, the major ones cover Google, Facebook, Twitter, and there are a couple others. Together, the FTC counted up and estimated that their consent decrees cover about a billion unique users. Now, we don't have a billion people in the United States, interestingly enough. So what this means is that the FTC has taken us into this kind of very complicated hybrid world in which, even though we don't have a law in the U.S. About privacy, as Europe wishes we would, we have a relatively robust enforcement effort, which is in fact acting in some ways to protect the privacy interests of European citizens as well as others. Now, just to state the administration party line so that Jay doesn't have to correct me, when the administration looked at this privacy landscape, the finding was that there's quite strong protection in many sectors, but there's a gap in this area of general commercial online interaction. That's why the Consumer Privacy Bill of Rights was issued. That's why, for the first time, the administration called for Congress to pass a Consumer Privacy Bill of Rights in statute so that this area, this sector that is currently unprotected by statute would actually be protected. So, to begin with, it's important, though, to recognize these differences. the Congress might, I hope will, pass a consumer privacy protection law that will fill that gap. But we will never in the United States, I'm confident in predicting, have a law that looks like the European data protection laws. We will always have a patchwork of rules, and we will probably always have areas that remain unregulated. Again, hence the need for interoperability. By the same token, it's very important to understand that from the European perspective, this is a gap which is pretty hard to get over, because from a European perspective, privacy is a fundamental human right. It's enumerated in the European Code of Human Rights. It's been adjudicated by the highest court in Europe, their equivalent of our Supreme Court. And from the perspective of Europe, to not have a kind of an omnibus statutory protection for this fundamental right is very hard to get around. Snowden didn't make it much easier. While there are those, I think, significant differences in the way that we implement our privacy values between the U.S. and Europe, I just want to underscore the point that Jade made quite eloquently, that we do operate, I think, under a common set of values. We are all democracies. We all recognize the importance of free flow of information, the importance of political participation, the risk to those values when individuals feel their privacy is threatened. And it's in some part, it's in some ways because of that, that the U.S. and Europe got together with other OECD countries in 1980 to adopt this shared code of common values. I think there's another difference that's important to recognize between the U.S. and Europe that does arise out of this common law culture versus the civil law culture. The caricature of the difference between common law and civil law is sometimes put like this. The common law says whatever is not prohibited is permitted, and the civil law says whatever is not permitted is prohibited. Now, the reality is you can do some basic set theory and realize that there may not be any actual difference between those two. But there is a philosophical difference that's not trivial. I think it has mattered to the culture of innovation in the United States that we tend to adopt new privacy practices, new privacy business models, new research styles, and then figure out whether there's a problem with them. And if there is, whoever does them gets punished. The view in Europe is somewhat different from that. I don't want to say it's entirely the opposite, but there's a fair amount of European culture that mitigates in the opposite direction, and I think that's just an important cultural difference, especially in the legal systems, to recognize. I want to just say two things about what I think the way forward is here. As Jade noted, there's a very well-developed view about how to reach global interoperability, how to function, how to make sure that the global internet marketplace, in which information is exchanged regularly, shared regularly across borders, across legal systems, where the rules are quite different. The question is how do you enable that to happen without requiring every single individual who's using personal information to have to be aware of what might be as many as 194 different sets of privacy rules. Frameworks such as the OECD framework are important, recognizes there are common values that are implemented in legal systems is important. I think especially important is cross-border enforcement cooperation. The OECD has actually led quite a bit of work in this area. You think about this very practically from the standpoint of a consumer protection regulator or privacy regulator in any country. Fundamentally, governments need to actually be able to protect their citizens. The internet has posed some threats to that. The U.S., candidly, has been kind of at the leading edge of some of those threats, as many of the more visible, more widely used internet services are based in the United States. And frankly, sometimes to a consumer protection regulator elsewhere in the world can feel like an invasion. So the question that a regulator, a consumer protection regulator, asks in any other country is, when my citizens are using a service, say, in the United States, and I'm not in the United States, and I don't have jurisdiction over the companies that are running that service, how am I going to protect my citizens? We have to have an answer to that question. There's ideological ranting and raving about whose privacy laws are better, whose are worse, and which promote innovation and which don't. But fundamentally, if we can't answer that basic question about making sure that consumers can be protected regardless of where their data is in the world, we are not going to have interoperability. So there's lots of good work that's going on in that front. And I would suggest, just as a practical matter, as research organizations think about the collection of use and use of personal information, if that data is coming from different countries around the world, there's got to be some practical account for how individual rights over that data can be protected in the event something goes wrong. I want to make just one final point about the challenges that we face. As I noted at the beginning, I think in many ways the big data challenges, the hard big data privacy challenges, I think actually fall equally upon the United States and Europe. I don't actually think that either of our legal systems has all the answers to the questions about how we're going to manage privacy rights in this large-scale analytic environment. And I want to just suggest that part of understanding what kinds of protection we need in the big data world require a bit of a shift in privacy thinking. Particularly in the computer science world, privacy has very often been reduced to questions of security. Data is considered private if it's kept secret. It's kind of obvious. It's the easy privacy case. If no one can get your data, there's no privacy threat to it. So we've had lots of effort in computer science over decades to deploy increasingly sophisticated mechanisms to keep data secret, to keep it out of the hands of people who shouldn't have it and only allow people who should get it, should be allowed to have it to get it. The problem is that this kind of serendipitous reuse that Cliff has talked about really poses questions about how personal information is used, not who has it. I would suggest that to a certain extent, in the world today, almost all data has already been collected, and if it hasn't been collected, it's often inferable from what has been collected. So trying to keep data secret in a world where analytics are more and more widely available is often, I think, an incomplete solution to privacy protection. This was realized, actually, in what I consider to be the very first big data privacy challenge that the U.S. faced, and this was back in 1970. There were these three companies, the three big consumer credit reporting agencies, TRW, and the other two have changed their names, so I can't remember which they were called. But all of a sudden, there was this prospect of essentially all consumers' financial transactions being collected and analyzed for the purpose of assigning credit scores, credit risk, to individual citizens. This was thought to be quite a good thing for making the financial markets more efficient, for making credit more widely available, in fact, for making it available on a basis that's more fair. It's not just whether you happen to know your banker, it's whether you could actually show that you were a good credit risk. But it caused enormous privacy alarm. And the solution that was developed was a statute called the Fair Credit Reporting Act, which established, as any of you know, if you've tried to go get a mortgage or apply for insurance, or actually if you got denied a mortgage, if you got your mortgage, you wouldn't even know about this law, but if you've ever been denied any kind of credit, you would know that you have a whole series of rights that protect you against misuse of this information. This statute does not actually give you the right to limit access to your data. The data has been already collected, but what it does is make sure that it's accurate, and that when it's used about you, you have notice of it, you have the ability to correct it if it's inaccurate, and that you're not discriminated against unfairly. So I want to just suggest that those principles, accuracy and protection against discrimination, are going to be tremendously important as we go forward in this big data world. All of you who are thinking about using large amounts of personal data, I think ought to be thinking about those principles, because in the end, I think a lot of the privacy questions that we face, whether they're in U.S. or in Europe, are really going to come down to those two questions, accuracy and non-discrimination. So thanks, and I'll look forward to the discussion and